This episode is sponsored by 511 Tactical, a company that I've used for around 14 years now and continue to use to this day. And they are offering you, the audience, a 15% discount, not on one purchase, but continuously. And I'll give you that code in just a moment. But I want to do a product showcase on their new Atlas sneakers and boots. So I'm a big believer in the fact that footwear can either improve our health or break down our health. And the Atlas sneaker actually has a new foam system that disperses the body weight, whether just the body weight, whether it's a vest and a gun, whether it's EMS bags being carried. And on top of that, they're lightweight, despite having the same protection that's required in the tactical space. So I have a pair of Atlas sneakers myself, and I can attest they're extremely comfortable. On top of footwear, of course, 511 offers a gamut of uniforms and equipment, whether it's plate carriers, backpacks, flashlights, you name it, they have it. All you have to do is go to 511tactical.com and use the code SHIELD15. That's S-H-I-E-L-D 1-5 at 511tactical.com, and you will save every time you purchase. And to learn more about the company 511 Tactical, you can listen to episode 338 of the Behind the Shield podcast with the CEO, Francisco Morales. This episode is brought to you by Thorne, the industry leader in nutritional solutions. Now, Thorne is actually trusted by 8 U.S. national teams and championship teams in the NFL, NBA, and Major League, as well as recently becoming the official sports performance nutrition partner of the UFC. So when it comes to supplements, the tactical athlete space and the athletic space need two things. We need efficacy, meaning the products do what they say they're going to do on the label. And then we need to trust the fact that we are not going to fail either athletic drug tests or work-related drug tests. Now, Thorne has actually been around since the 1980s, where they were used by physicians and hospitals for nutritional supplements for the patients. They were so successful that athletic teams and even special operations teams reached out to them, and they started supplying them as well. Very recently, they actually opened their doors to the general public. Now, what sets Thorne apart is they manufacture their own products in a state-of-the-art NSF-certified facility in South Carolina. They use only the purest possible ingredients, formulated with no stearates or arbitrary fillers, in the cleanest manufacturing process. Most of you listening come from a profession where it can take its toll physically and mentally, and many of us are not able to bolster our nutrition purely with the food that we eat. And that's where supplementation comes in. So if you're ready to maximize your health and performance, visit thorne.com, T-H-O-R-N-E.com. Take a short product quiz to be paired up with the perfect health and fitness supplements. And for you, the audience, if you use the code BTS10, behind the shield 10, BTS10, you will get 10% off your first order. And if you want to learn even more about Thorne, go to episode 323 of Behind the Shield podcast, and you will hear my interview with Wes Barnett and Joel Totoro from Thorne. This episode is brought to you by GovX, and as you know, I only have companies on here that I truly use and believe in myself. And GovX is a complete no-brainer. If you are a member of fire, police, EMS, corrections, military, and even hospital-setting doctors and nurses, you qualify for the free membership to GovX, which marries us with discounts from so many companies that you probably already use. And on top of that, it's not just for active duty, but also retirees, veterans, and volunteers. So for our professions, having to purchase so much of our equipment, every single dollar counts. And understanding that, GovX has reached out to you, the Behind the Shield podcast audience, to offer you an additional saving. On your first purchase of $50 or more, if you use the code SHIELD, S-H-I-E-L-D, they will give you an additional $15 off your first purchase. And another layer of GovX is GovX Gives Back. Every month they're going to sell a different patch, and the proceeds from that patch goes to a charity that supports either first responders or military. So as I mentioned before, go to govx.com, G-O-V-X.com, register for your free membership, and save every single time you purchase. Welcome to episode 411 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show Chuck Liddell. Now, Chuck is obviously a legend in the UFC, but also has a very powerful life story, from the mentorship from his grandfather, overcoming physical ailments as a young boy, bullying, his journey through martial arts, and so much more. So firstly, it was an absolute honor to talk to him. He actually did this conversation on Fight Night, on the day that McGregor and Poirier fought. So that in itself was amazing, but also he did it in the middle of his workday. So there is a little bit of activity in the background, some kids, some dogs, some squeaky chairs, but it doesn't detract at all from the incredible conversation. Before we get to that interview, as I say every week, please just take a moment, go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every 5-star rating elevates this podcast, making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library for you, planet Earth. So all I ask in return is you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to everyone else who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Chuck Liddell. Enjoy. Chuck, I want to start by saying thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you to Bill Grundler for connecting us as well. So welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, Bill's been a friend of mine for a long time. I wrestled with him in college, so been a while.
Yeah, well, as we were saying before we started recording, Bill definitely dropped some truth bombs on my community that needed to be heard. So I'd say that was one of the more needed to be heard episodes that I've done so far. He's fantastic. So my opening question is always, where on planet Earth are we finding you today?
I'm in Calabasas, California.
Beautiful. All right. Well, I love to start at the absolute beginning. So tell me where you were actually born, and then tell me about your family dynamic, what your parents did, and how many siblings.
Born and raised in Santa Barbara. It was an interesting dynamic, I guess. I mean, when I was really young, my father left. And I was raised by my mother and but we moved in with, you know, it was time we didn't make a lot of money. We were poor. So we had, we moved in with my grandparents. And so, but it was actually my grandparents and my great grandmother. So we had, my great grandmother was in one room. My grandma and grandpa were in one room. Me and my two brothers were in one room. My mom and my sister were in one room. So that, because I had two brothers, like two younger brothers and an older sister.
Beautiful. Well, I know, actually, funnily enough, quite a few high-level athletes, you had some physical issues when you were young. So tell me about those.
Yeah, I had an issue with, they wanted me to put me in those leg braces, you know, my mom, you know, like, so kind of like that Forrest Gump leg braces, you know, you see in the show. And we didn't have the money for it and didn't do it. But they had a bunch of exercises they gave my mom to put me through when I was really little, to help me keep my knees together. I forget exactly what it was called. She helped me with that for my book when I did it. So, but yeah, I think part of that helped me get started early, being having to go through a routine of exercises where she was, you know, kind of moving me through it and going through that pain and having a result that worked, you know, I think that started me early with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so you talk as well in the book about, you know, the parental figures in your family. Obviously, your mom was a single mother, but you had pops as well. And I think for this community, the audience that's listening with military and first responders, his story is actually very powerful from what he did in his career. So if you wouldn't mind, tell me who Pops was and how he was through your eyes.
Well, you know, my grandfather was he, you know, he stepped in to be my father figure, right? And you know, he had, you know, I mean, he raised me his way, you know. He is an old school guy from Brooklyn, tough guy that there who's getting in trouble, but then he went into the military, the war, and then. When he got out, he stayed in Santa Barbara and eventually became a deputy sheriff and then a sheriff's coroner. He's a big influence on my life as far as, you know, teaching me how to fight, teaching me how to be a man, really, you know, teach me how, you know, he was one of those guys I like, I don't know, my wife asked me, like, you know, about, because I always say one of my biggest regrets is he never saw me finish my career. You know, he saw me start, he saw me fight once, kickboxing. And, you know, and she said, oh, he must have been proud of you that night. You knocked the guy out or whatever. And I said, oh, he would have been proud of me if I got knocked out in the first round, because he knows I gave it everything I got. So, you know, for me, you know, he really put that in me where he, a couple things, he, and I'm trying to figure out how he taught it to me now. I want to give it to my kids, because I was never afraid of anyone growing up. Like, I wasn't afraid of him. And I'm never afraid of anybody, any man. Just because it's not like, it's kind of hard to explain, but I guess my feeling is that if you commit a fight and offense, we're fighting. You know, if you do something that requires me to step to you and fight you, I'm going to fight you no matter if I think you're going to beat me up or I think you're not. I think you have no chance in hell, right? So for me, having that feeling where you can walk into any situation where you don't have that fear involved, you know, and you don't have that involved in the equation. You can make better judgments. You might make better decisions, and I want to pass that on to my kids. And I'm still trying to figure out how he actually got me to feel that confident and that comfortable with being that way.
Yeah. Well, did he put you in, you know, uncomfortable situations as far as physically and that kind of thing when you were young to kind of almost like show you that there wasn't anything to be scared of from being in that discomfort?
I think there was a little bit of that. You know, me and my brother, we get in arguments and start, you know, he put boxing gloves on us and tell us to go beat each other up until we got tired. I didn't want to, panting. And, I don't want to, you guys aren't done. Keep going, you know. But a lot of it, more of his stuff was positive, and I never wanted to disappoint him. You know, like, he was always there for me, always did everything, helped me with everything, was always there for me. So I never wanted to disappoint him. So
now, with him being a police officer as well, when I look back at my career, I've been a martial artist most of my life. Always preface this, I've been a punching bag for some great fighters in my life. I've never been a, you know, competitive martial artist as far as professionally. However, I found, especially looking back at my younger years, I was terrified when someone tried to fight me face to face, but I was fearless if it was protecting someone else, if that makes sense. So did you notice that element when you were younger?
I don't think I was never afraid of anything, but I would, you know, I actually think it's pretty funny when you say something like that. My son, I was like a little nervous, but like I wasn't getting stuff across my son, because he's letting kids take stuff from him, and you know, they push him and take something from him, and they wouldn't do anything about it. And I was like, man, is he scared of these kids? Like, I gotta work on this, I gotta do this. And then my daughter had a birthday party. She's in kindergarten, I think, at the time, and we brought him with us at that to school, and some two boys, they're a head taller than my son, both of them, are hitting her balloons. She turned around, like, hey, stop hitting my balloons. And then he's standing there, and then the kids, they hit it again. He got right up in their face, looked just like my grandfather, too, chin out, right in their face, right in their face. Hey, don't touch my sister's balloons. And push the kids back, and they're like, you know, kids, whoa, you know. And I saw him do that again for her. Like, so he just doesn't care they're taking this stuff. If they want it, they can have it. He's a sweet kid. He's really nice. So it's just being sweet. He's not, but anyone does anything to his sister, he's right in there. Like, what are you doing? Get, you know, I got this. And so, you know, but that's kind of, I like seeing that. So I know he's not being afraid. So that's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what about your journey into martial arts? Let's talk about that. Was that following, you know, like Georges St-Pierre, for example, who, you know, was bullied and that was his kind of way through? Or did you just find a school and follow it that way?
No, I was bullied when I was younger, when I was really young, kindergarten age. And I was getting beat up, my lunch money taken from me, wrestled away from me and stuff. And actually the principal called up my mom and said, because he asked me, why don't you fight back? You know, this old days, the day back in the what is that, early 80s, 70s, late 70s. So he's like, why don't you fight back? And my mom said, I can't fight. And so they told my mom, had my mom come in, and she said, hey, look, I like what you're trying to do with this nonviolence thing, but you've got to let this kid defend himself because I can't watch him all the time. And the kids are, he's getting beat up all the time. And so she said, okay. And she took me to my grandfather, had him start throwing, teach me how to throw some punches and stuff. And then, you know, and told me, it's okay, don't start the fight, but you can finish it. You know, you can fight. If they attack you, you can fight. And I started defending myself, and people started leaving me alone. You know, it's, you know, and as they moving forward, I got about, when I was about 10, I really, 10, 11, I started watching Kung Fu Theater. And they had martial arts demonstrations in between, like a double feature, or they have these demonstrations on there. And I was so amazed by that, you know, those demonstrations. And I thought, you know, hey, I'm going to go join karate, and I'm going to learn some secret moves, and I'm going to be like, I'm going to be a ninja, you know, I'm going to be a super fighter. And, you know, and I kept after my mom. I was trying to learn out of books, you know, and stuff. And I kept after my mom to go and go. She finally said, okay, I'll take you, I'll get you into karate class. So we went looking for a place, and we actually went to a place that, it was funny that it's a Kempo place we went to. We went to a Kempo place three times, and it was the third time when it wasn't open where it was supposed to be. And I was, I don't know if we're going to go here. And we were walking home, and we saw the Koi Kan Karate Dojo was on the way home, on the walk, watched the wall and walk home. And why don't we check this place out? I walked in, and it was really lucky that I got in that place, because it was the perfect place for me. Because I was a real ADD kid, so I was really kind of hard to keep my attention, but I really, really wanted to be a martial artist. I wanted to learn karate. And when I went in there, they're the old style, they're old school teaching, you know, like they show you a reverse punch and tell you to go work. Okay, do that 500 times on each side, and then we'll come back and check. You know, so you're sitting there going, okay, I gotta do this punch 500 times on each side. Okay. And then they come back and but you had to get better at it. So they give you the next move. And I wanted the next move. I wanted them the next move. And they had a high attrition rate at 3 to 6 months. Cause I think that's when people figure out that there's no magic to this. You're not going to get a magic move. It's just hard work and knowledge and learning. And for me, the difference for me was I saw that as, wait, you mean if I keep working hard, if I work hardest, I can pass that guy. I can get better than those guys over there. And those guys over there doing that stuff I want to be able to do, I can get past them. The harder I work, the faster I can get past them. Oh, perfect. And I was there every day, all the time. Once I started, I was there. It was like an open thing. The gym was open from 10 to 8. You come as much or as little as you want, you know, 4 days a week, and then Saturdays were open for 4 hours. And I'd be there anytime I could be there. I guess I go after wrestling practice. If I got done with wrestling practice in time, I go to the gym, go to karate. I go to football games. If there's time after a football game, I'd go to karate. You know, it didn't matter. If I could get there, I'd get there. And so, no, it really, that's how I kind of got started in karate. I loved it. It's one of those things I love doing it, and I love learning more and I love sparring. And that was one of the things that was really great about that gym too, is like, you know, we had probably a good crew from, depending on what time of year, what year it was, but we had a good crew from, you know, 20, 30, 40 guys. You know, usually about 20 show up a night, but about 40 guys total that really like to get in there and fight, you know, and train together. And they're, you know, tough guys that could just brawl. I mean, Galtez brothers, I had a bunch of guys that I really had a good time training with, really tough guys. And it was just, you know, we beat the hell out of each other and make each other better.
Now, what were the the rules you sparred under? Because I did Shotokan, then I did Taekwondo, and you know, at Taekwondo I got national titles, but then was just over and over again, I was humbled when I started doing real full contact, because obviously the rules that I'd fought under in a way got in the way of me actually learning how to fight. So what was your experience?
Well, my experience, well, our rule, that was one of the things with our gym was that we had small headgear that we'd wear for like, and head contact was legal. You know, it was still more point fighting. So if you got one good punch, you're not going to follow up and chase them down, finish knocking them out. But we did. I mean, it was full contacts. We had these BOGU headgears, these big headgears that were, and that we used to be able to, same thing. It also helped you with you don't have a lot of peripheral vision in those things, so you had to get used to feeling where someone's coming from. But it was full contact, and sometimes we do stuff where it's like two on one. We did wall training where you're stuck with your back to the wall, you got to fight off the wall. A lot of different like street scenario stuff, and it was a lot. You're allowed to grab. You know, you could take the guy down. You could throw. I mean, we weren't doing any ground fighting yet, but you know, you were allowed to do takedowns, so that helped a little for that kind of fighting too.
So when you look back now, having you know trained in all these different disciplines now, you know, Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu, if you could actually take the Bruce Lee philosophy, absorb what is useful, what would you pull out of that art then keep to your current training?
Well, out of that, I kept a lot of it. I mean, a lot of stuff I got from there was I learned a lot of the basic basics of twisting my hips and throwing, getting the power from where you get your power from. A lot of the just move like and there's a lot of foot movement in that style, so a lot of that. And one of the things I did back then too, and we weren't allowed to do that, but I did it anyway. Like we had our kata day was on Friday, and I'd go for the minimum amount of time I had to be there for kata, and then I would leave and I'd go to there's a kung fu school on Friday nights would do open sparring. You know, so the first time I go down there, you go in this bar. And I've been in a bunch of street fights at that point. But the first time you go down there, you go down and you fight a Taekwondo guy. And he's coming at you weird. You know, it's a different – he's coming at you way, way different than the guys I'm used to. The guys I'm with, most of the guys I train with are all kind of street brawler type guys. You know, heavy bangers that want to – you got a guy coming with his flying kicks and you're trying to – okay, wait, what's going on with this? We come in there, guys, it's a boxer, and go in there and fight with them, or whatever, kickboxer, or whatever style they came from. But that was one of the things I think really helped me move forward as being a fighter, too. And even when I came back to our gym, and we weren't supposed to do that because you're not supposed to go outside the art or whatever. But I was a kid and I wanted to learn. I thought going in and working with other styles, working with other people. Made sense, so I did it on the side.
Well, now obviously you now as we're talking, you're in Hollywood yourself. What were some of the movies that inspired you back then as a kid?
You know, one of the ones I used to watch all the time too. I mean, it's funny, but the Master Ninja, that ninja show. I forget it was they called the Master. I think it was. It was like a weekly show, and it was the guys driving around him and his guy driving around in his van with a master, and they're going around doing things. It was really cool back then. I was like, oh man, I want to get home to see the episode. You know?
Yeah. Did you ever have that moment? Because I did. You know, you have as a wide-eyed child, you're watching, you know, the Karate Kid, Van Damme movies, you know, Kung Fu, the series, and then you get into martial arts, and one day you turn around and look and go, oh, actually, I'm a better martial artist than most of these people that were portraying them when I was a kid.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, you look at it and go, man. Oh, okay.
Illusion shattered.
I look at it. You know, now I guess I'm around movies and stuff, but I look at it as it's a movie. You know, you get they can't be. I mean, I guess get the get good actors as opposed to some of the big movies had good actors as opposed to having good martial artists. So it's all good.
Yeah. All right. Well, then lead us through your journey into discovering the UFC as a spectator, and then your journey into that sport yourself.
Oh well, as the fast version, I guess. I mean, I watched the first one. I was into fighting, so my buddy's like, "Hey man, this new thing's gonna be on. This, you know, 8-man enter, 1-man leave. Let's check it out. Like it's street fighting, and like you know, I remember going back to like the early one. Like Shamrock, I think, finished someone with a heel hook, right, or a leg lock, a straight leg lock, and my buddies were like, "What is that? Why did he tap? What? He's not doing anything. That doesn't hurt. Like, what?" And I'm like, "Wait a minute," because at that point I'd done a lot of martial arts. I've done a lot of reading, read a lot of different books on different stuff, and I've done a little bit of Kijujitsu. So I'm like, "Wait, let me see that. Like, okay, how do you do that? Let me see." And I figured out how to do a straight leg lock. You know, like, and I'm like, see that, how do you, does that feel good now? And like, my body's like, ah, you know.
Why are you tapping?
I thought that didn't hurt. And I remember back in the day, I remember Lorenzo Neal, who's a football player, if you know where he's at, was a really good fullback back in the day. A good friend of mine, but he used to always come in, "Why don't you do this, man? You're a wrestler. And you're a fighter, like you should be in the UFC." Like I'm like, "Yeah, so how do we get in?" "I don't know. I'll do it. Well, just get me in." You know, and everybody would talk about these tournaments that you did to get in, I always hear all these stories about, "Oh yeah, my instructor went to the tournament, but he was hurting people too bad, so they wouldn't let him in." And come on. And at that time, there was no tournament to get into the UFC. There was no, you know, it was, you know, you fought places and you got into the UFC. You know, if you were good enough, someone saw you fight, they go, "Oh, you want to fight in the UFC? Okay, good." And so eventually, like, I actually, Nick Blomgren, longer story, but he kind of got me into kickboxing. And then he actually got me into doing a mixed fight. He's like, you know, and my buddy Alfie Alcaraz, who trained with him, was like, I told him, "Hey, Chuck's a pretty good wrestler." And I was kickboxing for him, doing kickboxing shows. He's like, "He's doing a mixed fight in Vegas." And he's like, "I'm going to do like a couple of Pancras fights on my kickboxing show." So the open hand striking fights. And I'm like, "Okay, hey, Chuck, Alfie says you're a pretty good wrestler. You want to fight? Fight one of these?" I said, "Sure, why not?" So I went out and did it, and I knocked the guy out, head kick. I mean, one of the kick him right in the head, and his face goes straight to the floor. And a guy comes up and goes, "Hey, do you want to fight in the UFC?" And I'm like, "Sure." And I was fighting in UFC 17. I was an alternate to the tournament. And the rest is history, I guess. I mean, from there on, I fell in love with the sport and just kind of kept going.
Beautiful. Well, just you mentioned about open hand strikes. So what is your philosophy? I had Bas Rutten on the show a little while ago, and he was obviously talking about that for street fighting. What is your philosophy on open hand strikes in the real world outside the cage?
Well, I mean, they work. I mean, if you're worried about hurting your hands, I mean, they're a good option for you. I mean, I always liked elbows in the street because they work pretty good, and you can make them look like you're trying to push the guy. wait, hold on. Am I going to get myself in trouble here?
No, there's only police officers listen to this. You're fine.
Yeah, no, but I get. Well, yeah, I was doing a thing for police officers in the sheriff's department. They were asking me, the sheriff's department down here in Ventura asked me to do a thing on something that happened. They showed me a video of something that happened in a jail, and what should they have done different, and what could have they have done better, kind of thing, for in a small like PSA sort of thing to their deputies. And that was, I'm like, talking to the guys, I'm like, can I say stuff on here that talk about how they can get away with something, what make it look like it's something, or am I not supposed to talk about that? I'm like, just don't want to get anyone in trouble here. But I mean, that comes down to like a lot of the stuff is, people, it's like anything else. I used to watch guys get in a fight. I saw a guy chase a guy down once beside behind the bar. And, he's chasing after this guy. And the guy's like, dude, just leave me alone, man. I don't want to fight you. And he said, it was a big guy walking away from a little guy. And finally, the little guy hits him in the back, and punches him in the back of the head. He turns around and drops the guy, right? And then runs off. And then the guy gets up and starts running around looking for cops to turn him in. And a couple of my buddies came by, they were cops, and they're like, hey, man, did you see what happened? I'm like, look, yeah, but this guy punched a guy in the back of the head, and the guy turned around and hit him. Yeah. And the guy had been trying to walk away from him for 20 yards, So, so I don't know that you want to follow anybody. So I just say, okay, we'll take care of it.
Beautiful. But,
yeah.
Yeah. So with with going back to your kind of journey in the UFC, tell me about finding John Hackelman in the pit.
Oh well, that was before that. Like actually, now we'll get back to talking. So the guy that got me into fighting MMA was One Kick Nick. Actually, he's the guy that had me Nick Blomgren. He's actually the guy that got me into kickboxing. Because, well, I don't know if it's who you want to credit, but Alfie Alcaraz is a friend of mine. He's kickboxing. I was coming out to watch him fight in Vegas. Where I got there for the weigh-ins, and I'm sitting there at the weigh-ins, and Nick comes over to me and goes, hey, Alfie says you're a pretty tough guy. You want to fight tomorrow night? And I sat there for a second. I went, yeah, why not? I'm here. And he goes over to have me go check in and going to weigh in. And they're like, okay, how many fights do you have? I'm like, oh, I don't have any. Why? And they're like, oh, they kind of roll their eyes and look at Nick like, no, this is not going to happen. Because he was going to have me fight the guy at the main event. It was 15-0.
Oof.
And I'm like, he's like, I fought that guy my fourth fight. I think I knocked him out. But I think it was my fourth or fifth fight and I knocked him out. But that was later. But John Hackelman, I had met John Hackelman at a gym the week before that, right before I left for that thing. I went to the gym I used to train at, called me in to spar with this black belt that was coming in. And we did point sparring like at the gym, like no, not real head contact, but just like point sparring, like tap to the face and, we go hard to the body and you could do some, right? Yeah, I took him down a couple of times, but other than that, he was kicking my butt. And I hadn't had anyone kick my butt in a long time. So I got his card and they talked about training together. And his card said, world champion kickboxer. And I'm like, and so I put it in my pocket and didn't think about it. Went to watch the fight. And Nick said, well, since I can't get you on this card, I'll put you on my neck, go home and train. And I'll come back and I'll put you on the next one. I said, oh, okay, cool. And as I'm driving home from Vegas, I'm like, hey, I got that guy's card in my pocket. So I actually called John Hackelman up and said, hey, I want to train. I started talking, this guy talked about me about kickboxing. I want to compete. So yeah, I want to train. Come up to my house. So I came out to his house. Short version, I went up and I sparred with him. He beat the piss out of me for about 19 straight minutes. His buddy, Jesus Sanchez, who's another martial artist. His unofficial time was 19 minutes when he decided to call it. He was like, come on, guys, stop. I think he just got tired of seeing me get hit. I never boxed, just boxed in my whole life. John's had 200 amateur fights, probably 60 between boxing and kickboxing, like 60 some odd pro fights. It was raining. He's like, hey, will you come back tomorrow? I said, yeah. I rode a motorcycle up and it was raining. So I was going to leave. And he's like, hey, here, take my truck. I said, well, oh, no, it's okay. I'm fine. He's like, no, push your motorcycle. You come back tomorrow, right? Push your motorcycle back into my garage and take my truck. Send me his keys. That was the second time I'd met the guy. He threw me his keys and I left, and I came back for the next day to train, and we trained there probably 6 days a week for the next 6 or 7 years until we both opened gyms. And then we weren't always up there, but he was my coach ever since.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I think that what jumps out to me again is what I touched on earlier, which is when you're a martial artist, especially in the years that we began, obviously you ended up, you know, eons ahead of where I ever got to, but you do a style, you end up being successful in that style, but then you go somewhere else and you have your ass handed to you. And you have one of two choices then, either don't go back to that place or swallow your pride, realize you're a white belt again, and then start down that road.
Yeah, right. And one of the things John did was really great about was he's like, look, I'm just going to add to what you have.
So, you know, again, watching a lot of the build up in some of the later UFCs when they started doing all the behind the scenes and the training footage, you know, you saw you and John training, and obviously it was pretty brutal, like you said. So obviously the physical conditioning side was very hard. What about the level of contact? Were you guys hitting hard back then too?
Well, I mean, I think we were a lot better than a lot of MMA gyms because we both have experience from martial arts. We got our hard sparring in, we got our hard stuff in here and there, but it wasn't all the time. I mean, there's a time for really hard sparring. There's a time to timing training. There's a time to work on stuff. And I think we had a good balance of that. I mean, we got after it every once in a while. You know, he'd see it and see when we started going after and going hard with each other, and go, okay, if that's what you want to do, all right, go guys, have fun. We had a good balance of going hard and training, you know, remembering that we're training for things.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I found, again, my very, very brief, time I had probably in the closest thing I've ever been to Fight Club, which was Shootbox opened a gym in LA years ago on Melrose. And that there was literally just every sparring session was, you know, literally beating the shit out of each other. And yeah, I didn't really learn a lot.
I was going to say that's a good we're up to those guys like to go hard. Yeah.
So, but what I learned is that I didn't really do very well on technique. It was more survival, and I got good at getting hit. I mean, definitely increased my tolerance to impact, but I didn't feel technically like I advanced very much.
Yeah. I mean, I think we always did a good portion of, you know, training for stuff like techniques, back and forth stuff. We did a little bit, you know, we always did a little bit of back and forth stuff first, some spar, like shadow sparring. And then, you know, we'd have a few rounds to get after it a little bit, but it'll still be heavy working on things. You know, it's like, you know, I thought he did a real good job with that. John's real good at controlling the sparring and having it. Right. Cause I mean, I see some of these guys, I'm like, man, you really going that hard? It's like you're fighting. I see some guys, I remember back in the day, they're training 2 days before the fight, and I'm like, man, are you guys really going that hard at each other? I mean like, you might want to cool down a little bit. You don't want to hurt them before the fight, you know? Like,
yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I remember getting my nose broken, perforated eardrum, you know, definitely concussions, no question about that, you know, and having headaches for days. And now, yeah, being in that, even though it wasn't at a high level, seeing the discussion now, I mean, Max Holloway just had the most incredible performance. And I think that they're on the other side of the spectrum now, where he's almost only fighting really hard once he's actually in the cage.
Yeah, I mean, that for us, we had our, we'd have our times when we go hard, but I mean, everybody kind of knew it was sparring. You know, we're getting ready for this, doing ready. This guy's got a fight coming up. You know, I'm not trying to beat up a guy that's got a fight coming up next week. You know, I'm not trying to hurt. You knock him out, there's going to be some residual stuff when the fight comes around.
Exactly. Well, with the pit being, you know, forging men and women, obviously, you know, in fire in that particular facility or with John's training, one of the titles of one of your chapters that really stuck with me was you quote, being mentally tough is not a sometimes thing. And that really resonated with me in my profession. Like, for example, you know, our crucible, whether it's fire academy, you know, boot camp in the military, police academy, you know, that's the first step. And a lot of times if it's run well, it will be really hard to get through that. But then you have to hold that standard yourself and your employer as well through your entire career. You can't just pick and choose when something's going to be hard and then be a part-timer after that.
Right. That's one of the things I tell people. You're not, when things get really tough, you're going to do what you consistently do, what you consistently practice. Like if you're tired, so you quit, you're going to quit when it's important. You're not going to all of a sudden turn into be a mentally tough guy. You can't just turn on for a fight. You can't just turn on for this. And for me, it's always been, I actually reinforced that for myself actually after I retired. Cause I started doing, I don't have to do this cause of that. I've already done this. I did everything. I achieved everything. I'm done. I don't have to go work out. I don't have to do this. But it really caught my eye when I was actually running with my family. Like, I'm not running. We were going up stairs in Hawaii. And my son took off running up the stairs. And I started chasing. I started running after him. And, you know, I mean, and we're racing. I'm passing him up. And then I pass him up. I'm going. I'm like... And I actually, it crossed my mind, like, man, not because I was trying to be nice to him, but because I was tired, crossed my mind to let him go. And I'm like, man, am I really thinking that? Like, because I never questioned myself. It was never a question. Should I let someone win because I'm tired? Never crossed my mind ever before that. I'm like, and that for me was enough to kick me back into like, hey, you got to make this a habit to not quit or not stop it, because I'd said that before that. I used to say that. Now after that, doing that, I'm like, oh man, it really is. I'm letting myself slip to where I'm actually asking myself, should I give in because I'm tired and let him have it, or for me that was a big moment for me, just reinforcing what I feel about, you know, it's mental tough. This isn't it's an everyday thing. It's an all the time thing. You know, it's not, you can't just choose when to be tough. And I'm not saying like, and like there's situations where you're the only one that knows. I mean, I'm not saying when you have to play, like every time you wrestle, it's a gold medal match. You know, if you're in a position where you might get hurt and you're thinking, oh, I'll just let them have it because I don't want to get hurt right now. It's not worth, you know, getting hurt over. That's the difference. You know whether you made that decision for that reason or because you were tired and didn't want to fight for it. But you'll be the only one that knows that you made that decision. You know which one it was. You can't fool yourself. You know which one it was. So I'm not saying you can't be, you know, smart when you're training and working out and doing stuff, and some things are worth fighting over if you might get hurt doing it. But because, you know, I was that way as a kid too. Like sometimes when I was training, like, you know, I wouldn't give up anything just because I got to fight for it. Like, I can't stop. I can't give up anything and wind up getting hurt during training when you really probably shouldn't have taken it. It wasn't worth that risk. But it's a balance as you get older. But
yeah. Well, it's like you hear some of these guys saying, oh, I never tap. Like, well, then how do you train after they break your arm? I don't quite understand. Isn't it better to say, all right, you got me. I'm tapping. That, you know, lesson learned. Let me see if I can avoid that next time. But yeah, the tap is there so that you don't get hurt and you can continue training.
Yeah, and exactly. Like, I'm the last guy to tap to a choke, but that's a choice, right? No, but anytime you tap into like an arm bar or even if it's a neck crank, because sometimes guys, it looks like you got a choke, but it's really, he's getting a neck crank and then you're tweaking your neck, right? You know, that can be a long time recovery thing where an ego? You know, I didn't tap, but he busted my arm, but I didn't tap anyway. See, I'm tough. You know, my arm's not going to work for 6 months, you know? That's, doesn't make sense.
No, and even in, you know, like the CrossFit world, I coach and I'm a CrossFit athlete as well. It's one of the exercise, you know, methods that I think works well for our community. But there's that whole tendency to PR, you know, and the same with the deadlift. Like, you know, if you pull X amount and it's 85% of your max, brilliant. But if you hurt yourself on 100%, but you get a new number on the board, what have you achieved? Absolutely nothing other than 6 months of rehab.
Right.
Well, you mentioned cranks and, you know, locks. So again, up to this point in the story, you're a stand-up fighter and then obviously a wrestler as well. So tell me about your journey into jiu-jitsu. And again, was that humbling when you first started?
Well, Scott Adams was my partner in my gym, and he was doing jiu-jitsu. He had started doing jiu-jitsu, so I started training with him. And, you know, I took a class there at Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu place. I did one gi class, I think, and we did one without a gi with Marco Huas. I was first time doing stuff, and then I went. Actually, I still use a neck crank I learned in that day to this day with guys. I get one of Marco Huas's neck cranks all the time still. But then I went on to work with I think Mark Lehman taught me that. We did a jiu-jitsu class with Mark Lehman there too. Or he was working the desk maybe. I told him, man, I'm going to fight in the UFC, and he's like, yeah, sure you are. Yeah, it was funny. But then I started working with John Lewis in Vegas. And he started helping me get ready. Get ready for that fight and work with him for a long time. He was my jiu-jitsu coach for fighting. And I actually really love doing jiu-jitsu. I like it. I mean, it's one of those things where people are surprised. Like, I think I surprise people a lot of times when I do jiu-jitsu with them, because for some reason they think I'm still new to jiu-jitsu. I started jiu-jitsu in 97.
that's more experience than most people on planet Earth.
Yeah, I've been doing it for a long time. It's actually, and for me, I tell you, it's fun for me to learn, because there's so many things to learn.
Now, did you have a kind of humility story where you first went, you know, either gi or no gi, and, you know, again, were caught by something like, oh God, here we go again. I'm learning from scratch yet again.
Well, that for me, when I first put a gi on with someone, like I was rolling with John Lewis, who's at the time was fighting 155. So I'm not, you know, I was a two, well, fighting 199s or 200. And just he had that like spider guard, and like just he went to sweep me, and I'm like, just sweat me. I'm like, oh, like, because you can't, you know, I thought I'd get my hand out. I was at a pretty good pace. And I was really good at pacing out, and he taught me real quick how to do things. But or like, I mean, even like the arm triangle I got caught in from Jeremy Horn. I honestly didn't even know he had. I didn't think he had anything. And if I thought he had something, I think I would have got out of it. If I just started squirming right away because I knew what he was trying to do. I thought he didn't have anything, and there was only 10 seconds left. So I'm like, well, I'll just wait here. And he just slowly got tighter and tighter and tighter. I think back then there wasn't a lot of good guys out there. So I was rolling with guys that, or other guys who were learning. So I didn't get as much of that where, like, you got to step in and everybody's, you know, slick and doing all this crazy stuff to you. You know, so I was learning. I got to learn at my own pace. And I learned pretty quickly. And John Lewis would take me through things quick. One thing I did really good, I concentrated on about 20-25% of the techniques. I concentrated on staying in good position, getting out from underneath people, getting back up, and not getting caught in submissions. So I was trying to learn the basics of all the submissions as fast as I could. I've kind of perfected a few different moves of my own, and I was creative with it. I Scott Adams would roll the knee bar, and I use his technique for doing that. I'd roll the knee bar, and everyone thought I was going to the knee bar, and then halfway through, I just let go and pull my leg out and stand up, and everyone went, "Oh oops!" I thought I was countering that. Nope, he's standing up.
Why is he punching me in the face?
Yeah. So it was, a lot of it had to do, I just had to spend a lot of time trying to work on the basic stuff that I needed to stay in control and get back on my feet.
Now, did you feel like there was a kind of race for knowledge back then? Because just when people were discovering, you know, the Brazilian jiu-jitsu element, there must have been a sense of, I need to become better than this at this than other people before they learn more than me, because it was literally like this, people had almost never heard of it, and all of a sudden there was this like tidal wave of jiu-jitsu knowledge that people needed to learn.
Right, and it was, but at that time too, we were all trying to figure out how to put them all together, right? With gi, without a gi, no gi, with gi. How do you train sparring and wrestling and jiu-jitsu together, and how do you mix it together? How do you get ready for a fight? It was a big learning curve back then, and everyone. And I think the people that consistently did better were the guys that were really trying to learn and get outside. So you got some of those guys got stuck in like, oh, my style is better. I'm just going to stay with my style and I'm going to do my style. And those guys kind of started slowly slipping off. You know, if you weren't ready to evolve and improve, you're going to get passed up really quickly back then.
Yeah. Well, something that I'm getting, from reading your story as well is that, Muhammad Ali is famous for quoting that he hated training, but obviously, he was an incredible champion, but it was the time in the ring, I think, that he really enjoyed. Were you kind of the opposite, where you almost enjoyed the journey and the training more than chasing a belt or a title?
Yeah, I really was. I really loved every part of it. I like training. I like getting up every day. I like trying to figure out how to beat somebody. I like trying to pick someone apart, trying to figure out better ways of getting out of things. I learned a long time ago. You watch guys train something and teach something. And they don't always show everything that they do different. Like you see someone like, yeah, a good example. I watched Jake Shields. And this is a while ago. He teaches it now, but back when we were an Ultimate Fighter, he came in and was showing his guillotine. And I'm like, and he has a great guillotine. He finishes guys. He does a great job with it. And I'm like, what? Wait, he's teaching it the same way everybody else teaches it. He's not doing anything. He's not teaching anything different. And I was looking at him, but so what is he doing different that makes it work different? And then, oh, okay, that's what he's doing. He's got his hip. Okay, I see that. Now that, so I got used to looking for that. And I actually learned that after the first Ultimate Fighter. I was coaching the guys, and I was showing them a move that works for me all the time. Probably 85% of the time I use it, I'd be able to get up and get to a position I like, right? And it wasn't working for them. They just couldn't get it to sit, couldn't get it at all. I'm like, man, what? These guys are pretty good at what they do. I was talking to one of them, was four. I'm working with fours. I'm like, wait, do that again. What is he doing wrong? Why isn't he getting this? I'm like, oh, he has to push the arm first, and then he's got to get that little momentum going this way first, and then do the move for it to work. Because I didn't really even notice I was doing that. It was just, it was natural for me to do it. So it was natural for me to pop the person, so to load the hips a little bit so I could have the ability to make that move work. And he started doing this, and he got it. And he started working for him. So I'm like, oh. So, I mean, I think that first Ultimate Fighter really helped me as a coach learn to teach better. Because, you know, knowing how to do things is one thing. Knowing how to teach it's another.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, another thing that you talk about a little bit in the book is, you know, your love of chess when you were younger. And, you know, people that just know you as the man in the octagon probably don't understand the analytical side of your fight philosophy. So how much time do you take on actually analyzing an opponent before you fight them?
I try to go through the films and try to figure out when they were available. Back then, sometimes it was hard to get films on guys. The more film I have, the more time. So I always used to say, like, the more time I get to spar with you, the better chance I have against you. I'll get better against you every time we spar. You know, every time we train together, I'll get better because I know what kind of moves you do. I know what things you try. I'll start picking apart how you set up things and how you react to things. If I can figure out how you react to things, I can figure out how to land something. So I actually really like that part of it, like trying to figure out what trying to watch and do my homework.
Well, I know you've talked about, you know, wishing you could have had another fight with Rampage. If you could go back and talk to young Chuck, what would you tell him to do differently to be able to beat that man?
You know, I think I had some stuff figured out for that, but I just, it's one of those things that I need to mix some stuff up with him a little more, like, and, you know, do a little more wrestling with him. I think at that point, when I started getting away from, and I would go just going out and striking with guys. I got away with some of the stuff. I mean, I got caught that fight, the last fight. I thought, well, before that, I thought I should have had him too, but, you know, it's one of those things, going back, I should have done a little more, keeping him off balance, not letting him know you can just sit there and strike with me. I mean, I've given that advice to a lot of people over the years now, because I got away from, you know, just one of the things that made me great in the beginning is I could fight anywhere, and I could control where the fight was, and I kept guessing on what I wanted to do, whether I wanted to take you down or if I wanted to stay up with you. And when I got away from that, it you know, made it an easier fight for people. You know, they know what you're going to do, and it made it a little easier.
Now, you obviously peaked to the point where, you know, you were a champion for years. What was your mindset that kept you being able to focus on training when you were winning?
Well, I think that a lot of that had to do with I think as a fighter or it's more about the improving and the getting better and the actual winning of titles or winning of things lasts what, a couple of days, a week, you know, being getting excited. It doesn't last maybe a month. I don't know. I can't even remember how long I was excited about it. As far as I was more excited about who am I fighting next? When am I going to fight next? When am I going to be ready next? You know, and I think that was always the driving force, was that it's just the improvement and getting better and becoming a better fighter and chasing that who's next to prove I'm the best.
Yeah. Well, conversely then, so what about when you started having losses, you know, mentally, what was that like for you, you know, being on the top and now having each time to go back and figure out how to beat the next person?
You know, it's one of those things. I mean, looking back, it was tough. You know, it's one of those things, but it's always like, I always felt like when I was done, I always felt like, I always felt like I should have won that fight. I should have not. I know what mistakes I made. I know what I did wrong. I need to get back. I need to work on it. I'm gonna just get out there and do it. And I think I waited too long to actually try to change the way I was fighting, because I did feel like I got away from mixing up everything, and I should have been, mixing some of my wrestling in more with my striking and doing that, some of that stuff earlier. And I think it might have made a difference, but in the longevity of fighting. But, I fought till I was 40. So, I mean, I it was funny. I was watching a fight. Well, it was quite a while ago now, but they were talking about one of the guys I knew, and it's he was 31. And I was talking about him being an aging fighter, or being way past. He should have retired a long time ago. He needs to retire. He's getting too old now. And he was 31. I was like, okay.
But then you got people like Randy.
I won my first title at 35. So, I hung in there quite a while, and maybe the longer than I should have, but. I was still enjoying it, and I was, it would have been one thing if I was going out there and getting beat up and then knocked out. But I always felt like I was winning the fight, and I got caught and got knocked out. I could fix that. And, it is what it is. It's tough, but I always had that mindset. It was like, I can fix this and I can win. I can get back. Give me another chance. Right after I lost, I'm in the back room thinking, man, I can do this again. Can I have another shot at this? Give me one more. Let me try again.
Yeah. Which again shows that you were on that journey as opposed to just being focused on that win or that title. Okay. So then as far as transitioning out, my community, whether it's first responders, whether it's military, that can sometimes be a tough transition. We've identified for 10, 20, 30 years as a soldier, a police officer, a firefighter. And for some of those men and women, when they move on, when they retire, when they get hurt, whatever happens, that's a struggle mentally, identity-wise. What was your transition out of professional MMA like for you?
It's a tough thing, man. The thing I try to tell people all the time is you go from having something you're working for, chasing, going after, you have a reason to, do things for, 30 years. I've fought for 20, did wrestling, football, whatever it was, I had something coming up all the time, right? And then all of a sudden you don't. So for me, it was one of those things. I didn't have that. I always had that thing at the top pushing me or controlling me or encouraging me to do, make sure I stay on my workouts, stay doing this. I had a driving purpose, right? You had that purpose. And now that's gone. And, I think a lot of professions, a lot of different things, it's the same thing. That you don't have there's not a reason you have to do this, especially in, first responder type things or military. You have a reason to stay in shape, a reason to, to work out, a reason to go do this or go do that. Or not do this or not do that. And that reason's not there anymore. Now, I was blessed. I had a lot of opportunities, a lot of things to do, but also it's kind of a weird position to be in when you don't have anything.
Was acting kind of the other element, the thing that the next tribe, if you like, next community that you found yourself in that then allowed you to focus that energy?
That's helping me. Yes, that's one of those things. That allows me to try to get better at something. I don't want to just do it to. I know the cameos and stuff was fun when I was doing when I was fighting and stuff. But now I want to get better at it and keep getting better. And I feel like I am and keep improving every time I go out and do a role. So. yeah, it gives me something to shoot for, something to work at, and it allows me to stay in public and still be kind and try to make, you know, help people out and do some good things for people.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, so we talked before the show, you know, tell me about some of the work you're doing with some of these veteran nonprofits.
Well, yeah, we've got Emerging Vets and Players. Jay Glazer got that started, and working with those guys has been great. E3 guys at E3 Ranch in Kansas, I've been doing some stuff with them lately, helping some military guys. Jared Allen's Homes for Wounded Warriors in Arizona. I've worked with them for a long time. Great guy, great organization, helping guys out. And you know, I like doing things to help the vets and you know, all the first responders, the guys that, you know, they put their lives on the line for us and to allow us to have the, you know, have our rights and our lives, you know, and have a, be in a peaceful society and be, well, mostly peaceful, I guess. But yeah.
Beautiful. Well, one more area before we transition to some closing questions so I can let you go. In a podcast I listened to you recently on, you'd mentioned about getting stem cell therapy. So now it's been a little bit more time. What is your, you know, how did it impact you? Did you have success with it?
Oh, I had a lot of success. I had a PCL tear that I never got fixed, and that would really help with and my both my shoulders are just wear and tear, just beat up pretty bad. I mean, my shoulder doctor said, you know, it looked like I played in the NFL for 15 years, my shoulders. But I wasn't able to put my jacket on without someone helping me before I went down there and got and for the stem cells for that, I can tell you that you know, BioAccelerator really hooked me up, and they did a great job of helping me, and they, you know, those guys are great. If you can make it down to Columbia, you know, the BioAccelerator is amazing. Those guys did a great job, and it's very professional down there. They do really treat you good and take care of stuff.
Beautiful. No, that's good to hear, because you hear people trying it a lot, but you know, it's still somewhat new. So to hear people having results, I think is very encouraging.
Well, yeah, and you know, I talked to one of Tony Robbins' guys that kind of vets out the stem cell stuff for him, I think. He told me that, because I was asking him, how do I tell someone if it works? I know for my shoulders, it did wonders. So I don't know that works. And that PCL tear on my knee, it really helped. But like for other things, I don't know if it works for this or for that, for other things. So I asked him, what do I say to people? Because people call me, text me, hey, well, if it works that good, I'm gonna do it. But it's really hard on me. It's a really hard month. Anyway, I can get the money together, but it's rough. I just don't want to do it. It's not worth it. I try to tell you, there's no guarantees. Number one, number two. But he said was try PRP first, and if you have any success with PRP like stem cells, like PRP on steroids. So that was, I thought that was a good way to, for people that are trying to figure out if they want to do it or not. It's a cheaper way to try it out and see if they think it might have some lasting effect.
Beautiful. Well, just as you mentioned, Tony Robbins, you told a very interesting story about how, he was brought in. Was it John that brought him in to help you, after your first loss? Is that correct?
No, after first having two losses in a row.
Okay. So tell me what he did with you, and then if you still continue to practice that to this day.
You know, I think the thing that he did, it's hard to explain though, the stuff he does, but he does a lot of great stuff. But he's great, great people, works with people. I mean, one of the things he did with me was he just kind of got me back to realizing, I mean, realizing that, you know, it wasn't a big deal. You know, and go out and go back to going out and having fun, because that's what I always did that made me great at fighting. It was always fun for me. I wasn't, going to go out and be, because after losing two in a row, I was kind of all over the place a little bit, and like, oh man, should I be doing this anymore? And, you know, I think the biggest thing he did for me was a guided meditation, and he had me go through, you know, the five best moments of my life. And that guy didn't have me say one to him. He didn't tell the best moments of your life, basically, the top five. And at the end of five, he's like, hey, tell me, not one of those had anything to do with fighting, did it? I said, you know what? No, not one. And he said, well, then quit worrying about it and go out and have some fun. Yep. All right, man. That's some of the best advice I ever had. And I went out. That was the last fight I won. It was before that. So, yeah, he came up to my room the night before that fight. So, for the Wanderlei Silva fight.
Beautiful. Now, with I know in the book you talked about not drinking at all when you were younger. It's funny because this is going to sound weird to American ears, but I drank till I was 16, because in England, you know, it's kind of a little more socially acceptable to drink with, you know, meals and stuff when you're younger. But then I had a bad, you know, over-drinking accidental episode, and I didn't drink through most of the years where my friends started drinking. But then you hinted in other interviews about, you know, towards the end of your career, you did find yourself drinking. So kind of what was that mental journey for you where you found yourself kind of off the path, and then how did you pull yourself back on to where you are today?
I think once I retired and it was the brakes were off, you know, I just was really, I just decided I wasn't, didn't think I was doing anything wrong, but just I'd go out and drink, I'd party, and I didn't have a reason not to. So it wasn't like before, I was at a fight coming up, I had to go train with somebody, I had people where I was working out with, I had people to answer to, I had people that I was that I felt like I owed to be there for them. And you know, I was retired, I didn't have anything else. It was real easy to get going and started, and I, you know, it started, it didn't last for long, but I got to where I was, you know, drinking 3-4 times a week, and then started going, and, you know, and it's actually one night I was, long story, hard to explain, but I was supposed to meet up with my now wife, and ended up just not being able to figure out how to get up, like, call up to her room from the keypad at the front of her apartment, and I was like, you know, and then got myself out of that with her, but decided not to drink for a year and took off drinking for a whole year, and just then I just kind of now got to back to drinking when I'm every here and there when I want to, and when I, you know, not a big deal anymore, but I just kind of needed that wake up call to not, you're free, you don't have to have any responsibilities, but you know, you might want to stay in a little more control than that. But I think that was part of the thing of just having everything released. Like, you know, I didn't have to be back in the gym. I didn't have to do, you know, this or that. You know, it was just, oh, I'm just gonna have some fun. I deserve it. I earned it. You know, well, at some point you've got to get back to doing something else, or you know, get motivated another way.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that, because I think it's very, very, very important and parallel to many of our journeys. I mean, I can say the same thing. I never drank to get, you know, shit-faced, for lack of a better word, but I found that the frequency of my alcohol consumption post-retirement, you know, went up, and it really reminds me of your story, chasing your son up the stairs. It's like you have to monitor yourself, and when you get that warning sign, be able to draw it back in before it goes too far, and then you're way too, you know, you've got a lot of work then to get yourself back from there.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to be mindful of your time, so I want to switch to some closing questions so I can let you go, especially on today's big day where Connor and Dustin are fighting. So thank you again for doing the interview on that day. So the first question I'd love to ask, you have a biography. It's named Iceman, which I read and is phenomenal. So everyone listening out there, I urge you to read that to truly get the full story. Are there any other books that you love to recommend to people? It can be related to what we've discussed today or something completely different.
Yeah, reading the Bible a lot more lately, but other than that, you know.
Yeah, no problem. The Bible's a great answer. We'll stick with that. All right, so then the next question I'd like to ask is a movie or a documentary that you recommend. Now, before we get to the answer, so you had Cage Fighter come out last year, so I want to make people aware of that. And then also the 30 for 30, Chuck and Tito, I thought was an incredible documentary as well.
Yeah,
so,
those guys did a great job of covering a lot of complex issues in a short period of time. As best they could. I mean, I thought it came across really well.
All right, next question. Is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast to talk to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world as a guest?
I mean, any of those guys, like Jared Allen would be great. Get him on here. He's a good dude, good for people. Yeah, I don't know. Adam LaRoche, another one, friend of mine. He's a guy from E3. Those guys, those guys are, you know, not only supporters but helping vets quite a bit. So they'd be good guys to talk to.
Perfect. Thank you so much. All right, then the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find you online: what do you do to decompress these days?
I still, to be honest, to decompress, I still hit the bag. Do jujitsu, hit the bag, roll, spar, so anything having to do with martial arts. I that's my kind of my happy place, and where I get the time I can, you know, that shut my mind down and just think about that.
Love it. All right. Well, then, very last question. Then, if people want to reach out to you, find you, follow you online, where are the best places these days?
It's at Chuck Liddell on most of the social media, like Twitter or Instagram. I think we're going to get chuckliddell.com up and running again soon, but we haven't been doing that for a while, but we're going to get running again soon because I got a few things coming up. I'm probably going to be starting a podcast sometime later this year. And we also have I'm going to put a show out, No Chucks Given, which is going to be more like it's kind of like a travel show, but just me doing what I like to do, things I like to do, and showing you the area I'm at when I'm doing it. So it should be pretty interesting. Should be some fun stuff.
Beautiful. All right. Well, Chuck, I want to say thank you so much for you to take time out of your day, especially today, which is a big fight day. And obviously your family in the background, so I'm taking you from them too. I truly, truly appreciate you taking the time to speak to the audience today. So thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure, man. Take it easy.